The headlines: Iran tells EU foreign policy chief that it will not back down from its red lines. In the Vienna negotiations, blaming the West's lack of serious will for prolongation of the talks. Palestinian resistance movements condemn Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain, saying such trips will never legitimize Israel's occupationist policy. And Russia's foreign minister says there is still a chance to ramp up diplomatic efforts to resolve the current standoff with the West over Ukraine. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian president says that Tehran is seeking a real removal of anti-Iran sanctions in the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ibrahim Raisi says the rights of the Iranian nation must be respected. He made the remarks in a meeting with the Irish foreign minister in Tehran, Simon Coveney. For his part, said the Iranian nation's lack of trust is due to Washington's failure to abide by its pledges, and thus is understandable. He said Dublin believes that other parties to the JCPOA should offer necessary guarantees to Iran during the Vienna talks if they are seeking to revive the accord. Coveney is on an official visit to Iran. Earlier on Monday, he also met with his Iranian counterpart. During a presser with Coveney, Hossein Amir Abdullahian urged seriousness from other parties in the Vienna talks.
We believe that if the U.S. and the three European countries show seriousness in returning to the full implementation of their commitments under the JCPOA, reaching a good agreement in a short time is achievable.
Amir Abdullahian said Iran is serious in hammering out a good deal with the framework within that is the framework of the JCPOA. He said that Tehran is keen on reaching a swift agreement which will secure Iran's national interests. He also said, he noted that the American side sends messages of goodwill but practically doesn't take any tangible actions. Amir Abdullahian also urged Western powers to stop what he called playing with time. The top Iranian diplomat also discussed the Vienna talks with the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Borrell said the negotiations have reached a crucial point, urging flexibility from the parties involved. Amir Abdullahian, however, stressed that Iran will not compromise with its red line in the talks. He also criticized the Western signatories for prolonging the talks by showing a lack of serious will. Earlier, we asked history professor David Yavubian about Tehran's insistence on the actual and verifiable removal of sanctions against Iran.
Iran entered into the negotiations regarding its civilian nuclear energy program with the Obama administration for one thing, to achieve one thing, and that was sanctions relief. Unfortunately, the Obama administration never lived up to its commitments, and I believe that President Raisi, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, the foreign minister, they're concerned that basically what is coming will be a repeat of 2015, where there was ostensibly goodwill in the air, and the United States was going to meet the commitments that it had signed on to on paper. And instead, what we saw was the Obama administration reneging on U.S. commitments, maintaining the sanctions, and therefore not enabling Iran to benefit from the agreement that it had signed on to. And I think that it's very important that the Iranian negotiating team remain vigilant at this stage to make sure that certainly what is coming, and that is American attempt to weasel out of its commitments, is not going to be humored. The Iranian negotiating team has been crystal clear throughout all of the negotiations in Vienna regarding Iran's primary demand. And if this demand for verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief is not met, then the JCPOA will simply not be returned to.
Elsewhere, Palestinian resistance movements condemn the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum said such visits can never legitimize the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. Barhoum held Bennett responsible for the atrocities Israeli forces commit against Palestinian people. Also, the Islamic Jihad movement has strongly condemned Bahrain for hosting the Israeli Prime Minister, saying such trips bring nothing but threat and danger to Arab states. Bennett arrived in Manama on Monday and will meet Bahrain's Crown Prince and Prime Minister during his two-day stay in the country. Meanwhile, hundreds of people rallied in Manama to voice solidarity with Palestinians and denounce Bennett's visit. which coincides with the anniversary of their 2011 uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. Bahraini political activists in Iran have held a presser to highlight the atrocities of the Bahraini royal family against its people. The press conference comes on the 11th anniversary of Bahrain's 2011 uprising against the ruling Al Khalifa dynasty, Yusuf Jalali reports.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up, and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free, and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complained about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qasem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al-Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russia's foreign minister says there is still a chance of striking an agreement on security with the West as the two sides remain locked in a dispute over Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov made the remarks in a meeting with President Vladimir Putin. The top Russian diplomat suggested continuing and ramping up diplomatic efforts to resolve the standoff, but not indefinitely. In another sign of a potential easing of tensions, the Russian defense minister told Putin that some of the massive joint military drills with Belarus were wrapping up. Moscow seeks security guarantees against NATO's eastward expansion, including a permanent ban on Ukraine's accession to the military alliance. It also denies Western accusations of planning an invasion on its neighbor. The U.S. says it will temporarily relocate its embassy in Ukraine. Liz Truss is Britain's highest-ranking diplomat at the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA, as well as the minister representing the U.K. in the tense standoff between the West and Russia. Hermina Taylor takes a closer look at the woman some are dubbing the new Thatcher.
Liz Truss has gone from political also-ran to holding one of the highest offices of state in the UK, the country's representative to the globe. Promoted by Boris Johnson from International Trade Secretary to Foreign Secretary, with the additional job of solving the Brexit standoff with the EU, as well as pushing through with the talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA. Truss has only been an MP since 2010. Whilst her in-tray may be overflowing, reports reveal the behind-the-scenes briefing Truss has had, this to gauge support as she fights a silent battle with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's seen by many as her main rival for the Prime Minister's position should Johnson quit or be ousted. Truss's shift from staunch Remainer to ardent Brexiteer via a Margaret Thatcher-style makeover has not convinced everyone of her Iron Lady credentials.
I think Liz Truss is regarded by a lot of backbenchers as being quite lightweight. I think there's possibly a bit of sexism in that, but although the Conservative Party has had two women leaders, unlike Labour. I think we've also seen Liz Truss last week in Moscow really banging the war drums, trying to show how tough she was in regards to the whole Ukraine-Russia question. And I think part of that was to please Tory backbenchers.
It's a short walk from the Foreign Office to Downing Street, a fact that would not be lost on Liz Truss and her advisers. It's also a short political step from one of the senior offices of state to the top job. Just ask Boris Johnson, who was Foreign Secretary before replacing Theresa May as Prime Minister. For a politician with such an important diplomatic brief, scandal has followed Truss with question marks about her judgment. Highlights or lowlifes include racking up thousands on expenses whilst on a three-day trip to Japan, claims of cronyism and using the expensive members-only club owned by a Tory donor during her stint as trade minister.
It doesn't seem to be held against anyone in the Conservative Party. We've seen lots of this around the test and trace thing at the beginning of the pandemic. We've seen Boris Johnson's flat. We've seen all sorts of stuff around this, and it doesn't seem to ever come back in anyone. So I don't think that's going to bother most Conservative MPs and most Conservative members.
It seems Liz Truss's major selling point is not her intellectual gravitas or political track record. In fact, the opposition points out she did not actually finalise a single new deal that the UK did not have with the EU as trade minister, but rather she's the anti-Sunak, a flip-flopping ideologue who is not an ethnic minority. For some Conservatives, that may just be enough. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen is facing a worsening health crisis amid the ongoing Saudi blockade that has choked off its access to fuel and medical equipment. Rare fuel is the lifeline for generators that feed medical oxygen plants. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
The fuel shortage in Yemen is taking a heavy toll on the health sector. Officials in charge of medical oxygen plants say they are among the worst affected by the shortage. The problem is rooted in Saudi Arabia preventing the entry of ships carrying fuel. They are also blocking imports of medical equipment.
The halt in the work of oxygen plants means deaths of thousands of patients, including those who suffer from chronic diseases and need constant access to oxygen. Some plants have partially shut down, and the United Nations must do its duty and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition is clearly intent to kill Yemenis, whether by targeting homes with airstrikes or by cutting off medical supplies to them.
The Ministry of Health says only 13 oxygen plants are now working.
As a result of the blockade on Yemen and prevention of fuel ships' entry, the output of oxygen plants has decreased by 45%, which may lead to a complete inability to provide oxygen to health facilities. The fuel crisis caused heavy losses to 13 oxygen plants that used to produce over 6,000 cylinders per day, and this fell to nearly 3,000 cylinders, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients, including children.
Yemen has been suffering under the blockade by Saudi Arabia and its allies since they began their deadly aggression on the country in March 2015. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the siege has pushed at least 300 health facilities to the verge of collapse as their generators stopped working due to the severe fuel shortage.
Yemeni health officials say only half of the country's health facilities are still functional and over 80% of Yemenis face significant challenges in accessing basic care services. Many people here believe that the United Nations should be held responsible for remaining silent toward the illegal Saudi blockade imposed on Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Israeli forces have raided a village in the West Bank city of Jenin. A Palestinian teen has been fatally shot and dozens have been injured. The house of prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat has also been destroyed. He's accused of carrying out an operation that resulted in the death of a settler last December. We have a report on that.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah. as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Most Canadian taxpayers would be shocked to learn they are subsidizing a group raising funds for a university enmeshed in Israeli regime colonialism and militarism. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Yves Engler, writer. This article is published under the heading Time to End Canadian Taxpayer Subsidies for Israeli Regime Apartheid. Stay tuned for more. Amnesty International's recent conclusion that the Zionist regime is committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians should galvanize opposition to Canada's most significant form of support for the apartheid regime. Some 200 registered Canadian charities raise over $250 million a year for projects that directly or indirectly subjugate Palestinians. Through tax receipts and other tax benefits, the government subsidizes up to 50% of these donations, despite many of these charities contravening Canada Revenue Agency regulations that forbid support for foreign militaries and West Bank settlements. For example, Canadian Friends of the Hebrew University, CFHU, raises millions of dollars a year in support of a school with a campus in East Al-Quds and strong ties to the Zionist regime's military. CFHU also directly sponsors initiatives that support the IDF. Part of Hebrew University HU is on land in East Al-Quds that Zionist regime forces seized in 1948 and 1967. At neighboring HU's Mount Scopus campus, the Palestinian village of Isawiyeh was expropriated to host dormitories and other facilities for HU students. While it is in a largely Palestinian area, HU is dotted with Jewish nationalist iconography, reports Somdeep Senator, a professor of International Development Studies at Rockside University. A sign on a wall on campus dedicated by the American Friends of Hebrew University declares HUJI, a University of the Jewish People. Another sign says that research and teaching at the university is conducted for the benefit of Israeli regime and the Jewish people. HU has significant and long-standing ties to the Zionist regime's military. It awarded scholarships to students who signed up for IDF combat units during the Zionist regime's violent outbursts in 2002 and operates a training center for military intelligence officers. To maintain the IDF's technological edge, cadets have studied for degrees in physics, math, or computer science at HU for over 40 years. The university provides the IDF with academic information on students enrolled in the Talbiot program. In a story on Talbiot, Jason Gerritz writes, "The opening years of the program saw the students first and foremost as soldiers. They wore uniforms to their classes at Hebrew University and took shifts guarding Talbiot's section of the Hebrew University campus." In 2019, HU began offering a 3-year training for future IDF intelligence officers. Students in Havatzlot program live in a former university residence only accessible by biometric identification. Regular university employees need advanced permission to enter the area. Funneling Canadian taxpayer-subsidized funds to an Israeli university supporting the IDF and occupation should lead to questions about CFHU's charitable status. But the registered charity with chapters in 7 cities across the country also channels funds to initiatives specifically designed to support the IDF. In April 2018, Ottawa CFHU launched the Ottawa Scholarship Fund in support of reserve duty soldiers studying at the Hebrew University. At the event, according to CFHU's annual report, 4 students shared their inspiring stories from their military service and explained what it means to be a reserve duty soldier in the IDF. A 2019 story on the registered charity's website noted, Health, CFHU send former IDF combat soldiers to university, while an ongoing funding pitch says, donate in support of CFHU's scholarship campaign for soldiers studying at Hebrew University. In July 2021, wealthy Calgarian Lenny Shapiro financed a number of CFHU scholarships for students who have served in the IDF. CFHU and HU matched a portion of Shapiro's unspecified contribution. Most Canadian taxpayers would be shocked to learn they are subsidizing a group raising funds for a university enmeshed in Israeli regime's colonialism and militarism. They would be completely outraged by CFHU's support for initiatives that directly assist the Zionist regime's military and contravene the rules for registered charities. So why hasn't the Canada Revenue Agency audited Canadian Friends of the Hebrew University and ended this shameful and illegal support for the Zionist regime's apartheid?
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.
Assalamu rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a big question, and that is the compatibility between religion or religious beliefs and science. As we know, most of the scientists are concerned with the objective findings. For example, throughout the history, the objective sciences, which are done in laboratories or are done in the field of study or something like that. As we can find in the religious studies, you know, we are mainly concerned with the divinity or with the divine, the supernatural powers, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and all of this. At the first glance, it might look that there is no compatibility between religious beliefs and science or scientific beliefs. The main thing is up in the minds of the people, especially of the 21st century, who are, as you can see, busy with different materialistic things around. And the case is that they expect the science to answer all their questions in terms of their body and their mind, you know. And they do that. But when they get to the religion and religious beliefs, they say, this is something ancient. This is something archaic. We cannot, for example, expect a religious belief who was revealed, for example, at least 1,400 years ago to solve our problems today. What's your answer to that?
Actually, you know, I think the problem is even deeper than that. You know, nowadays we are encountering a new phenomenon called new atheism or, you know, the scientific atheism. Unfortunately, this type of atheism, actually, we had the atheism throughout history. But that one, you know, the old one was normally a sort of philosophical or a metaphysical atheism.
We got even Church of Science today.
Yeah. Okay. So that one was, you know, normally based on philosophical argumentations or refuting scientific philosophical argumentations of the other side. Mm-hmm. But this one is a sort of, you know, as you said, the worshiper of science, or they call this trend as scientism. So they sort of, you know, believe that the only thing that could be confirmed and could be understood as a real thing is what that be, you know, observed or experimented upon. So this is unfortunately the problem that we have nowadays, and they are sort of dismiss all sorts of metaphysical or supernatural things that might exist over there. So I think there are a number of answers or replies that we can actually provide them with. One of them is that even though that they may claim that they are sort of evading metaphysics and, you know, things that are supernatural, but they themselves, you know, when they are talking about science, they are presuming, you know, and they have many assumptions based on metaphysics. For example, the logic that they are using that is completely metaphysical, you know, you cannot prove logics by experiment, you know, that's based on the way that human being thinks, and you know, and there are many actually presumptions and assumptions that are using in new sciences, even though that they try to dismiss all sorts of, you know, metaphysical.
Isn't it because of lack of understanding or recognition of the power of Allah and divinity? Because I've heard some of these new atheists and these atheists, you know, who are very much nowadays, if you Google it, you know, they are really active on the world. Say we do not understand divinity and the supernatural powers, but at least we can be successful understanding the materialistic world around.
No, the problem, as I mentioned, the problem is the way that they approach towards things, you know, and they call it the philosophy of science. So the foundations that they are laying out there in order for, you know, acquiring knowledge, the only foundation to them that could be laid out is just, you know, the observable foundations and whatever that could be experimented.
So
if you talk about something supernatural that is beyond natural, you know, nature, so that is nothing to them. You know, that's you're talking nonsense. So the first step that we have to take encountering these people is, you know, to break this foundation that they're making. You know, the way that they approach the world is not limited just to natural things. This naturalism that they are talking about, sometimes they call it, even some of them, to our surprise, some of them may even believe in God, you know, but they say the way that we approach science must be just materialistic. So they call it methodological naturalism.
That's all right.
But I don't see that. How can they go on, you know, with their belief in God with that methodological naturalism? So if you ask them, how do you believe in the miracles? So, you know, you're a believer. We have these people. Let me just name one of them. There's a famous person. Actually, he used to be an atheist, but he converted to Christianity and he became a theist, Francis Collins.
Yes.
A very famous person, book of, you know, The Language of God.
Yes,
and so, you know, this person is a methodological naturalist. But, you know, I'm wondering how such a person can answer the miracles that happened, you know, by the hand of prophets of Allah, prophets of God, you know, throughout history.
So some of them some of these atheists through their, you know, experiments, could not find the answer to so many questions and find this complexity, for example, of the brain, of the mind, of the galaxies around, And at last, they believe in the superpower.
No, actually, more fundamental than that. First of all, the presumption that science can answer all our questions and, you know, in our day-to-day life. Or look, there's so many questions that science is still not aware of. It just can't find an answer to it. For example, where did the first single cell come from, right? There is no answer to it. You Google it, you go to NASA, you go to any university, look for that answer. They don't know the answer. And they say it very clearly. We don't know where the first single cell came from. Okay. They have many theories about it, but none of them really fills that gap. They still don't know where the first cell came from. Point number two, about the dark matter, they're not able to come to a conclusion what the dark matter is all about. If that explosion happened with a mini difference, nothing would have come into existence. So how come that precision took place at that time? They have no answer to that. More than that, let me tell you, actually, you know, if you just give it a little thought, you will realize that this theories that they have come up with, the Big Bang theory and the evolution theory, this is nothing other than religion. Look, when you talk about science, we say science, all the actions or the experiments that you do, either they are observable, and then you should be able to recreate them in your lab.
Yes.
right? And then the results should be same. And when that happens, then you call that science. All right, great. Look, let's look at evolution. Who observed it?
Okay.
No one observed it, right? Can you recreate it in your lab?
You're talking about Charles Darwin theory now?
Yeah, I'm just giving you an example that why science is actually not science, and it's basically a faith system that they're believing in, and then they turn around and question the religion. We say, okay, evolution. Did you observe it? No, we didn't observe it. All right. Can you recreate it? No, we can't recreate it because it takes a long time. Fair enough. So now you can't observe it, you can't recreate it, and you are not sure that it'll give you the exact same results, right?
Yes.
So then how do you believe in evolution? We have signs in front of us. What signs? We saw the bones of dinosaurs, we saw the skeletal structure, the fossils, and blah, blah, blah. All right. Okay. And based on the science, we believe in something called evolution. Well, that's what religion is all about. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, look, you're not able to find me. You're not able to believe in me. Look at the signs around you.
Yes.
Look at the signs and believe in me. And that's what they're doing. They're looking at the signs of all these fossils around them and then believing in something called religion. So this is basically a belief system. Where is your empirical data here? Where is your positivist approach here that, look, this is what it is? No, you can't recreate it. You can't observe it. So basically that is also a faith system, but they have some data in their hand and they want to call it science and they question us for believing in something based upon science.
When we get to the text of the Holy Quran, we can find the story of the creation and Adam and Eve, you know, with the creation of the world. But the case is that sometimes I myself believe that the believing people around the world, including the Muslims, expect the Holy Quran to answer all the scientific questions. And this is not good, I think. I mean, from a book of the guidance, you expect it to answer your daily questions, your routine life questions, okay? Of course, there are so many laws over there, Islamic rulings over there, you know. But the great thing is that, you know, I think you are taking it wrong. You are taking the wrong way and you are taking the wrong path. The case is that the scholars of the Islam during the history trusted in the Holy Quran, the prophetic tradition and ahadith, the infallible imams, their conduct. At the same time, they did not stand still. They researched and studied a lot, and we can find it in the life story of so many of the scholars.
Correct.
A new world, because of the basira, because of that, you know, light that were into their mind and heart, was open to them. Yes. And this is the true enlightenment, I think, the enlightenment from inside, not the 18th, 17th century enlightenment of the West, putting religion aside, and then everything will be lightened for you. Isn't it, Sheikh Hassan?
Yeah, actually, I believe that, you know, going back to that compatibility or incompatibility of religion and science, you know, we may say that, you know, even though that with respect to science, we're not always sure, and that actually they themselves say that we are not trying to be, you know, certain about things. We are just, you know, try to sort of judge about our hypothesis based on the evidence that we have. So, you know, what I understand is that, you know, we cannot, we're not actually forced to sort of see that there is a sort of, I don't know, a sort of independence, relationship between religion and science. Because they normally say there are four types of relationship that you may, believe existing between science and religion. This is compatibility, incompatibility, dialogue, and independence.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, some religious people, they think that it's a sort of independence relationship between these two. I don't believe so. I believe that there is a dialogue, or even there is a sort of, witnessing from both sides, you know, to the other. So, for example, we nowadays, actually, since maybe 40 years ago up until now, we have some scientific evidence for, approving and confirming the God hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Recently, there has been a French book, you know, by Michel-Yves Ballouret and Olivier Bonacieux, you know, about 600 pages, you know, God, Science, and Its Proofs, Advent of a Revolution. It was written in French. This is the bestseller book, you know, and these two outstanding scholars.
And it's not just that book. Yeah. Actually, there are many other books. There is another book, The Return of God, The Return of God Hypothesis, written by Stephen C. Meyer. Yes. Actually, you know, we have this fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, which is one of the very beautiful, you know, evidences or arguments, new arguments, another, you know, renovated way of, you know, argument from design, actually, which is so beautiful. And it's actually using, there are three, four premises. Yes. In the first premise, it's using the quantum physics, cosmology, and giving some evidence that the whole world is finely and, you know, so strictly fine-tuned in order for life to exist over there. And then in the second premise, it talks about, you know, probability theory and, you know, evaluate the hypothesis that could explain those fine-tuned, you know, constants of physics or natural laws and things like that.
Yes.
And, you know, consider all those hypotheses. And then at the end, the result of that argument, it reaches to this result that the best explanation, actually they call it the IBE, the inference to the best explanation that is used nowadays in science, is the design hypothesis. So, you know, we see that, you know, even science can not only being in conflict with religion, but also confirming and giving more force to, you know, religious teachings.
Okay, thank you very much. We are done for today's discussion. We are out of time. If you got any final remarks, we've got about 1 minute, Sheikh.
Well, I think in this last 1 minute, I would say that let's keep this misunderstanding aside that religion and science are incompatible. While Islam has been promoting knowledge and research and scientific development, so look at it as a subset, science being a subset of religion, because religion deals with two dimensions. And people who feel that religion is not supporting science is a misunderstanding, is a misconception. People can get into science and be a professor and be an innovator or be a scientist and continue to be a monotheist. And
that's all right.
There is no contradiction in it. So I am actually, I hope many people, youth particularly, get attracted towards science and go and do research and all that while remaining on the path of Sirat al-Mustaqim, inshallah.
That's all right. And which one is more important? I mean, having knowledge of your very matter or your soul, you know, and you have a world within yourself as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you have to discover it more and more and to find where is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and what is the place of divinity inside you. They can, I can find the center of the world and the galaxy, inshallah, in you yourself as a human being. The best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, thank you very much, Shaykh Qasim and Shaykh Qasim Ali Himani. It was very kind of you to be present in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and on other episodes of this program, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside, I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He is closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials, so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by U.S. drone strikes. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kevin Gostzola, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Suppressed Whistleblowers Who Exposed Massacres in Syria. Stay tuned for more. Whistleblowers in the United States military exposed a strike in Syria that resulted in the massacre of around 70 women and children, according to an investigation by the New York Times. The command responsible for the strike, considered a war crime, may have taken place, but a report by the Office of Inspector General for the Defense Department removed this opinion. Officials in the Pentagon impeded an investigation and ensured no one would ever be held accountable for the civilian deaths. They also turned on one of the whistleblowers, forcing them out of their position in IG's office. What happened proves once again that going through proper channels can be a fruitless and risky career-ending effort. Lisa Ling, a former tech sergeant who worked on drone surveillance systems and is a known whistleblower, reacted, "Again, the public is notified of a war crime by a brave whistleblower who was eventually forced out of their job. This is a pattern that exemplifies the need for robust whistleblower protections, especially for the intelligence community so often carved out of them. We need more light shined in these secret spaces so this doesn't happen again and again and again without the public knowing what is done in our name." As the Times reported on March 18, 2019, in the last days of the battle against Daesh in Syria, when members of the once fierce caliphate were cornered In a dirt field next to a town called Maroz, a U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets. But it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. U.S. military forces launched a double tap strike. An American F-15E attack jet dropped a 500-pound bomb. As survivors scrambled for cover, another jet dropped a 2,000-pound bomb that killed most of the survivors. A high-definition drone recorded the scene prior to the bombing. Two or three men were near a compound. Though they had rifles, neither engaged coalition forces. Women and children were observed in the area. At nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The death toll was downplayed, reports were delayed, sanitized, and classified, and the Times added coalition forces bulldozed the blast site. The strike was the work of a classified U.S. Special Operations Unit known as Task Force 9. They were responsible for the third worst casualty event in Syria. According to the Times, an unnamed Air Force intelligence officer in the Combined Air Operations Center at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar contacted Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, who was an Air Force lawyer. They were ordered to preserve video and another evidence from the F-15E squadron and drone crew. Corsack concluded a possible war crime was committed that required an independent investigation. He noted that Task Force 9 was clearly seeking to cover up incidents like this strike by logging false entries after the fact. For example, the man had a gun. The Air Force's Office of Special Investigations was notified. However, as the Times recalled, a major refused to investigate. Civilian casualties were only investigated if there was a potential for media attention, concern with outcry from local community and government, and or concerned sensitive images may get out. In other words, if the Pentagon needed to get ahead of a potential scandal, they would investigate and craft a narrative that could tamp down outrage. But they did not believe the Bowles strike would ever make headlines. Corsack tried once more to convince his superiors to investigate in May 2019. They still refused. So Corsack filed a hotline complaint with the IG's office in August 2019. Gene Tate, a former Navy officer who had worked for years as a civilian analyst with the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Counterterrorism Center before moving to the Inspector General's office, told the Times, "When Corsack came to us, he wanted to make it very clear he had tried everything else first. He felt the IG hotline was the only option remaining. Roadblocks prevented Tate from having any success. He could not find the footage from the task force drone that called in the strike. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM removed the war crime finding from a report on the massacre." In January 2020, according to the Times investigation, the Deputy Inspector General refused to sign off on a memo that would have alerted authorities to the war crime. Tate did not hesitate to criticize leadership in IG's office, and by October 2020, he was forced out of the office. In May 2021, Tate contacted the Senate Armed Services Committee and sent a 10-page letter that detailed the Bowles strike. However, as of November 13th, he was still waiting for any member of the committee to call him back. To further illustrate how stunning it is that senators on the committee ignored what Tate shared, CIA officers in Syria were so alarmed by the conduct of Task Force 9 that they complained to IG's Office for Defense Department. According to one former task force officer quoted by the Times, CIA officers alleged that in 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. The New York Times shared their reporting with CENTCOM prior to publication and asked for official comment. CENTCOM acknowledged 80 people were killed but insisted the strike was justified. The bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people killed, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in Daesh sometimes took up arms, according to CENTCOM. This is actually part of the legacy of President Barack Obama's administration. He developed a method of counting civilian casualties that would not box him in. In 2012, the Times reported all military-age males in a strike zone found dead were presumed to be combatants unless there was explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. If commanding officers refuse to support an investigation into a massacre, then they never have to worry about an investigation moving death in the combatant column to the civilian column, which would make them look bad. On November 3rd, the Air Force released the findings of the investigation into the U.S. drone strike in Kabul on August 29th that killed Zimari Ahmadi, an aid worker and father, his 3 sons, 2 of his nephews, and 3 girls who were toddlers. They exonerated themselves. The investigation found no violation of law, including the law of war. Air Force Inspector General Sami Sai declared, "We did find execution errors combined with confirmation bias and communication breakdowns that regrettably led to civilian casualties." But Saeed is undoubtedly implicated in the cover-up of countless war crimes committed by Task Force 9 and various other special operations units which engage in similar bombing attacks. Meanwhile, drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He's closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by the United States drone strikes. Commenting on how the cycle of violence with militant groups continues, Link stated, "They don't hate our way of life. They rightfully hate our way of killing. 7 innocent women and children were needlessly killed in Syria, 10 killed in Afghanistan, and plenty more we will never know about. These are human beings, and we took their lives while using sanitized words with fancy legal footwork to get away with breaking international law. It is wrong. It is terror. And I believe Americans are complicit as long as we remain silent about what is being done in our name." Link concluded, "We cannot fight a war on terror with more terror."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.